Quentin Tarantino is on the line for this edition of The Literary Life. His first novel has just been published. It's a novelization of his film Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. But don't be fooled. In true Tarantino fashion, he has redefined a genre, given us an homage to those books once found in newsstands and drugstores, and in the words of the Washington Post, this first novel may even herald the start of a new direction for this relentlessly inventive director.
Thanks for moving it back. Oh, I really appreciate it. I hope I'm not calling too late.
Not at all, Quinn. In fact, I'm glad that I almost didn't quite make it on time either. So thank you, though, for hanging in there with us.
My pleasure.
I am really honored that you're on this podcast and that, you know, you're here with me. I'm a huge fan, as you might imagine.
Thank you very much. It sounds like it's going to be a very exciting conversation. Thank you.
Initially, like anything, I initially thought, well, you know, what could this be? I loved everything you did with it. I love the ads. I love the old ads.
That was so important. We're like, okay, look, the books of like 1978 all had like, you know, 4 pages of ads. We got to do that.
They really, really did. And then what you've created is something which stands in and of itself apart from the film. So, you know, you basically, you know, it made me go back and watch the film again, you know, and it's like two different works of art. I just can't tell you how remarkable it is. And I have to say, you know, I'm, you know, in this bookstore world buzz of the indie bookstores, and basically everybody is reading this book now. I think it's a number one bestseller in one day, and you should feel very proud of that. I've had people texting me, you know, one guy trying to be a jokester said, you know, I just love this thing. I bought it yesterday. I read it. It would make a great film.
That's a funny guy. That's actually kind of exciting. You run a bookstore and you can feel that there's excitement for that book and people have been asking about it. That's really cool.
Quinn, we just reordered hundreds of copies more because of the interest and what's happening.
Fucking awesome, man. This is news to me. I mean, I know it's doing good, but I haven't heard any, you know, I used to work at a video store, so I know what it's like when it's like a big video drops and stuff and people wanted it. That's really exciting.
I know that it's always hard to hear these things, but for someone who called you one of the most influential, you know, filmmakers of your generation. But to me, you basically turned on an entire generation to things that interest you. Unfortunately, the things that interest you are really interesting. So talk a little bit about that. Talk a little bit about just how you've gone down these rabbit holes of things that you've loved, you know, of influences that you had, and you kind of like, you transformed them into something new.
Well, it's funny because, I mean, you can definitely make the case I'm doing that with the movie novelization to some degree, where I've taken these different, in the movie world, I've taken these different genres and subgenres that oftentimes, you know, weren't treated with that much respect from, like, you know, the first string critics of the big newspapers, you know, whether it be Hong Kong kung fu movies or all the different weird little subgenres, a bunch of Men on a Mission movies, spaghetti westerns, that kind of stuff. But I always loved him, and or blaxploitation movies. I always loved those, and I wanted to do my versions of them. But I really wanted to do my versions of them, where I took what I considered the pleasures of those genres, because I didn't want to do an art film meditation on a blaxploitation movie. I want to deliver the goods. For people who like blaxploitation movies, I hope you'll like Jackie Brown. And I want to take the flavor of it and the joys that I find inherent in the genre. But then I want to add my spin and hopefully, you know, elevate it a little bit. Now, some of those movies that exist don't need elevation. They're actually good on their own. But I'm trying to aim for a slightly higher and definitely slightly more idiosyncratic view of the given genre without losing the pleasures inherent in there.
And I think you've succeeded. And you're right that you've succeeded in the movie tie-in. I predict that in about 2 or 3 years, we're going to have about 1,000 movie tie-ins that people are going to try. But I don't think anyone can really quite succeed like this. I mean, the reviews have been...
Thank you very much.
The reviews have been spectacular. I mean, New York Times, Washington Post.
I was surprised by that. I thought they were going to be really snotty to me and everything. So it was like, when I read that first New York Times review, I go, this almost sounds like a rave. And the editor goes, oh, it's a rave.
It is a rave. I mean, Dwight Gardner pulled out all the stops when he says, if it were written better, it'd be written worse.
Yeah, right.
which I loved.
Yeah,
it's a mess. It's a mass market paperback that reeks of mass market paperbacks. I love that. I mean, it's exactly what you were, seems like what you were shooting for.
What led me to it was the fact that, look, you were saying that, like, as a bookseller, you never really took a movie novelization seriously, but me growing up in the 70s, you know, being a little boy and becoming a teenager and a young man at the end of the 70s, movie novelizations were probably like the first adult books I ever read.
Wow.
Maybe like, you know, my mom or one of my mom's roommates, like, you know, had some like cop book or something, you know, that right. they were reading. And then I picked it up off of the coffee table and started reading it myself. But when it came to actually me going to like a 7-Eleven and going through the spinner rack of the paperback, it was like novelizations that I first started reading, and they were my first adult book, and I read a lot of them. I read novelizations for movies I never ended up seeing.
So they were really fresh for you at that time.
Yeah, they were, you know? they were really interesting. And then as time went on, I really realized that there was like a vast difference in them. I mean, yes, there were the ones that were like probably 5 or 6 day jobs where they just basically took the screenplay and then broke it down into prose form. Those definitely existed. But there was also some like really terrific novelists that really the only really lucrative gigs they could get were novelizations, and they really poured their heart and soul into some of them. And almost invariably, all of their novelizations were better than the movies that that they were based on. And then there's also a shitload of novelizations that were done by the original screenwriter. My favorite author of novelizations is this fellow named John Minahan. Now, John Minahan had a whole series of crime novels called, like, The Great Robberies. It's like The Great Hotel Robbery, The Great Diamond Robbery, The Great Wall Street Robbery, The Great Hotel Robbery, things like that. I read, like, one of them. I can't quite get through it. I don't love it that much. But his novelizations are just terrific. And I don't think he just did anything that came out there. He had a tendency to pick movies that I think that he thought would make good books. And so he did the novelization to Mask. He did the novelization of William Friedkin's Sorcerer. He did his best novelization, I think, is from the James Bridges movie, September 30, 1955. It's called 9/30/55, the book.
Right.
He did the Steve Tesh, Peter Yates movie, Eyewitness, and he completely did it better than the movie. But the thing about it, one of the things he did that was, when he was just a really terrific writer, but one of the things he did was he almost always did his novels from a first-person perspective.
Mm.
And so take any movie you can think of and then just rewrite the story from a first-person perspective. Well, you've changed it drastically by just doing that.
Were you also interested, I'm sure you were, in wonderful films that were adapted from wonderful books? You know, I can think of, you know, a favorite of mine, you know, Lee Marvin's Point Blank.
The Hunter.
Did you find yourself reading those as well?
Oh, yeah. No, I discovered the Parker series in the 80s, and it was a complete revelation because, you know, we were living through the 80s, which was like this incredibly politically correct decade. And one of the things, after coming off of the 70s, where characters, you know, they could be fucked up, all right? They didn't have to be heroes. They, you know, Travis Bickle is not a hero. Joe, right. Peter Boyle's Joe is not a hero, but there's like there's interesting fucked up characters, and the movies, you know, were about those characters. But all of a sudden in the 80s, it all changed. And like every lead character had to be likable. And likability was everything. And even if they had a sense, a different kind of iconoclastic sense about them, in the first hour, the last half hour was going to change that.
Yeah, it's true.
They had to be redeemed. Well, in that antiseptic decade, I discover Parker.
Right.
You know, he is just a professional robber, and that is just what he is. And you know, he's all about the profession of his trade. And, you know, he's not a cold-blooded killer. I mean, one, because that would be unprofessional. But, you know, if, like in Point Blank, if he gags the secretary when he's robbing the office building and she ends up suffocating, well, that's too bad. But, like, you know, those, them the breaks.
Well, you know, we share a love for Dutch Leonard, Elmore Leonard stuff. Yes. And I think he falls into that category as well. Mm. Someone writing in the 80s, you know, like he wrote one of the great books about Miami called La Brava. I don't know if you know that book. But
he falls into that. And like you, and in some ways, almost the more fucked up his characters are, the more you love them.
Absolutely. And his detail with dialogue, I know that only from his Miami books, because he would say something like, all right, don't take that road. Take the other bridge. It's faster. You know, he knew. He had such detail that way.
Oh, but, yeah. Same thing with his Detroit books. Okay, go to the party store and blah, blah, blah.
Right. And, you know, those guys.
Pop as opposed to soda.
Exactly. And, you know, you're absolutely right. In the 80s, they were not what we think of them today. You know, in the 80s, they were a little bit unheralded, pretty much, in the 80s. I remember we did an event with Elmore Leonard at the store, and he was talking about how hard it was. One day, he wrote a novel. He didn't know who to turn it into. So he called his publisher up and said, hi, this is Elmore Leonard. Can you tell me who my editor is? and when they couldn't tell him, he said, it's time for me to change publishers at that point.
I have to tell you, it was a real thrill. My proofreader, Kathy, ended up that she was Elmer Leonard's proofreader on Rum Punch.
Wow. Oh, really? Wow. Yeah. He was such an original. And there's another person who was friendly with him, and he's from Miami, and that's Charlie Williford.
Oh, yeah. I figured you were going to say Williford. But especially the Hoke Mosley novels.
Completely.
The Hoke Mosley novels are masterpieces.
You would have loved Charlie. He was really one of the sweetest, most interesting guys around.
I would say of all the series of books I've read, they were the ones where I couldn't wait to see what was happening to the supporting characters in the next book.
Great.
You know, his Latina partner, what was going on with her? What was going on with his two teenage daughters? I was always really curious about the supporting characters, and they've always usually had like, you know, big leaps in their life by the time he picked up the next book.
Right. But let's talk about you as a reader. I mean, everyone knows you as a filmmaker. You know, I remember as a kid, I couldn't get enough of, you know, The Red Balloon, Curious George, and then I went into the Hardy Boys. Books always meant something to me. Did you grow up in a house where books meant something?
Yeah, well, I mean, like, you know, it was interesting growing up in the late 60s or the early 70s because, you know, I'm not reading the big adult paperbacks that are, like, everybody's reading, but, like, I knew what they were. You know, I knew that everyone was reading The Godfather. I knew that everyone was reading Love Story. I knew everyone was reading The Sensuous Man and The Sensuous Woman.
Right, right.
The first author I think I got turned on to, other than like reading something like Encyclopedia Brown or something like that,
right?
I think I'm going to remember his name correctly. In the fifth grade, I had a really cool librarian that was I had a nice little relationship with her, and she pointed me to a children's author. I believe his name was Roy DelRuth. And he wrote a whole series of books. The first one that I remember, and you could look it up and find out if that's his name. The first one I remember was a book called $3 Mule.
Hmm.
And she was really bragging about this writer. She thought he was really good. And I read the book, and I thought it was terrific. I thought it was a really good book. And well, she was a fan. I think he had a bunch of books. And so she had, you know, a whole mess of them in the library. So then I just started reading, like, one Roy DelRuth book after another. And so that was actually like the first time I really got on to an author and I really liked an author and started reading their stuff. And then, you know, then pretty quickly after that, I got out of like YA novels. And then I think I just started like picking up like the a book that looked interesting that was on the coffee table that my mom had just read, or one of her roommates had just read. Now, look, because I love movies, I was always attracted to a book that I thought would make a good movie.
I'm sure you were. You started writing screenplays really young, didn't you?
Yeah, I never finished anything, but I started trying.
So it was like
a book about cops. All right, but right. would be attracted to me, or like a serial killer is doing something, and there's a cop after him. You know, those were the kind of like books that I was drawn to, because I would like make the movie in my mind as I was reading it.
Did you go through your science fiction period?
You know, I did, but half-heartedly, frankly, to tell you the truth, because I was I wanted to like science fiction more than I did, but I did go through a little bit of it. I read one Robert Heinlein novel.
Right.
I bought Stranger in a Strange Land, but I can never get through it.
But you did go through your comics period, right?
So that's different. No, I've been reading comic books and collected comic books for a very, very, very long time. And so, instead of going through a science fiction period when that didn't quite work out for me, I went more through a horror novel period.
So Stephen King.
I didn't read as much Stephen King as a lot of other kids might, but I definitely read some. I read I remember reading Cujo in particular. I was a real fan of Cujo. But I made it a point, again, trying to pick books that that could be a film that hadn't been made into a film, and then it wasn't the biggest deal out there. Like, I didn't read Audrey Rose. Everyone else was reading Audrey Rose.
Right. Or V.C. Andrews, right?
Yeah, I didn't read that because everyone was reading that. I wanted to find my own.
Is there a secret book out there that you think about, wow, this would make a great film?
No, there's a few. There's definitely a few. I mean, one, if I just wanted to make a good movie, all right, and I'm coming from a more of a place than just making a good movie. I like facing a blank page and filling it myself, and knowing that there was a time, even when the movie's way finished, that, you know, oh, wow, there was a time when it was just a blank notebook, and I put the first word on paper. I like knowing that that's the origin of it all. But if that wasn't the case, a book that I think about often, about how good a movie it would be, and I kind of know how to do it, would be David Morrell's original novel for First Blood.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Now, they made it into a movie, and it's just an entertaining enough movie, but it doesn't hold a flickering birthday candle compared to the book.
Right.
I mean, forget about the fact that they throw away the whole point of the book in the movie when Rambo doesn't kill the posse who's coming in. Because the whole point of the book is that, if you take some guy and turn him into a killing machine and drop him behind enemy lines, well, that's all well and good, but at some point you got to put him back into society.
Completely, yes.
Yeah, so, it's almost the same storyline of Roman Gary's White Dog. But the thing about it, though, is, you know, the sheriff character is so fantastic in the book, and the Rambo character and the arguments he has with himself are so fantastic. It's one of those books that the dialogue is so great, you almost cannot not read it out loud.
And in essence, in some ways, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, this novel is kind of the reverse. You had your film, and now you're able to sort of add things to the characters that you might have thought about doing but didn't do in the film.
It just ended up being especially a thing on this script, is I wasn't in any hurry to write it, so I tinkered with it for about 6 years or so. And part of the way I tinkered with it, and part of the way I learned about the characters, was writing them out, writing out scenes. Not necessarily scenes for the movie I was going to do, but just scenes that, gave me edification on the character and who they were and Rick's career and stuff like that.
Right.
And so I learned all this stuff. But, you read the book. Okay, so there's this... The chapter towards the end when Rick and the other actor, James Stacy, go to the bar and just kind of shoot shit after shooting their episode for the day. Well, I wrote that. I wrote that down at some point, but I never even bothered to type that up. I mean, there's no way that's going to be in the movie. The movie's not going to hold a 40-minute scene where just two characters shoot the shit in the third act.
And the other thing you're able to do in the book, which I appreciated, was you're able to play with genres. You gave big chunks of different you know, stylistic things that you probably couldn't do in the film that you were able to do in the book as well.
Yeah, I wanted to do that in the movie, but it didn't survive. It ended up getting cut out.
I wouldn't mind. I wouldn't mind if it was 6 or 7 hours to watch
it. I had a lot of fun, you know, writing the couple of Lancer chapters where it just becomes like an Elmer Leonard Western or a Louis L'Amour Western.
Right.
As a matter of fact, when I was meeting different editors who had published the book, I asked one of the editors, I go, "Well, what did you think of the Lancer chapters?" And she goes, "Oh, I like them." She goes, "Arguably, they're the best written chapters in the book because you're not trying to sound like you." You're right. I'm not trying to sound like me. I'm trying to sound like Max Brand.
that's really funny. You've hit it out of the ballpark with this. So does this whet your appetite? I know that. You know, I don't know how the media picks up on these things, but there's that thing going around that you're going to do only one more film. And then, you know, who really knows, right? None of us really know what the future is. But do you think you might do some more fiction? Is that something?
Oh, I absolutely intend to. I mean, I definitely got another book coming out. I'm writing a book on a cinema book, you know, a nonfiction book of essays and reviews of films of the 70s.
It's coming out this fall.
Yeah, it's I'm not quite done with it yet, but I'm getting that first draft. It's getting down there.
Cool. Well, I would love for you to be writing more fiction. It's really, really good.
I really appreciate that. I've got two chapters of an original story going. I don't think it's very pulpy though. But I got to finish my cinema book before I can get back to it.
Yeah, tell me about, you know, you've had so many changes. I mean, the whole world has gone through changes last year. But you started going through all these changes prior to the pandemic, right? I mean, you got married, you moved to Israel, of all places, right?
Yeah, I got married, and we didn't mean to just move to Israel and that's it. Well, my wife is Israeli, so the idea is, you know, we'd spend 3 months or 4 months in Tel Aviv, and then come here and spend 3 to 4 months in Los Angeles. And then I did something that took me somewhere else. We'd go somewhere else. But then my wife got pregnant. She had the baby. And a month later, the pandemic hit. We were kind of stuck in Israel for 9 months.
And what was that like for you? I mean, it must have been, in some ways, kind of cool. You were able to write and you were able
to spend time with your
family.
Yeah, look, I was planning on being home most of this year anyway because I was I just had a son.
Right, right.
Yes, I wanted to be around him, you know. I wanted to, you know, spend that time at the house. And I was finishing up the second half of my novel. So, it all worked out great for me, you know. It would have been nice to go back and forth a little bit more than we did. But, I mean, how much are you going to go back and forth with a kid during the first year anyway?
Yeah, exactly. And Tel Aviv is quite a city, right?
It's a great city. It's so exciting. And, you know, it's very similar to Los Angeles. It's just where Los Angeles is huge, Tel Aviv is tiny.
Right, right. It does have its distinct neighborhoods.
Yeah.
And you can actually walk to all of them.
That's the biggest thing is, I barely feel like we even need to lock the door. It seems so safe compared to America.
So will you go back? I mean, you came for the publication, but you'll be going back to Israel at this point.
Yeah, I'm probably gonna go back in August, and then in September I'll be going to Europe to promote the book because then the hardback will be coming out. But then me and my wife and my son will come out to Los Angeles after that European part is over, and then we'll probably be here for 6 or 7 months.
Cool. That's really. Really great. And so what are you reading now?
I read a cinema book that I really, really like. I mentioned that that director, James Bridges, the guy who did Paper Chase and everything. They did a critical book about his film called The Films of James Bridges that was really, really good. I really, really enjoyed it. Right now I'm reading one of Michael Crichton's first books when he was writing under the pseudonym John Lang because he was a medical student. And he had these ideas for novels that he wanted to write them, but he didn't want to publish them under his own name because he thought that if his professors in medical school saw that he was writing books, they would think he wasn't serious. He wrote a book called Binary that was actually his first movie he ever made. He made it as a TV movie in the 70s with Ben Gazzara called Pursuit. And I always remember that movie, and I thought it was cool. And then Hard Crime or whatever that new...
Hard Case.
Hard Case came out with a new edition of it, and it's a lot of fun. Okay, yeah, no, I have read a book that I really, really liked, and it was another hard case book. It's a book called Nobody's Angel. It's about a Chicago cab driver, and then there's this serial killer out there who's killing cab drivers. And he thinks he's maybe seen the car that might be doing the job. And it's written by a cab driver in Chicago.
Wow.
And he's not really a professional author. I think it was a big deal that this book got published. He wrote this book and I think maybe another one, and he would just give it out to customers. It's a terrific character study, and you know you're hearing the straight dope from the cab driver. It's just filled with all these anecdotes, and the way Cabrini Green is this place that the cab drivers don't go. It's almost like this negative mecca, you know, right in the middle of the city.
Right. Remind me of the title again. What is the title?
Nobody's Angel.
Nobody's Angel. That's great. We're gonna have to get it and put it right by the counter there, I think. That sounds really right next to yours.
Quentin Tarantino recommends.
No, that sounds fantastic. Do you remember the old Black Lizard books? You know, the ones that Sonny Mehta from Knopf published.
I have a bunch of the old Black Lizard books. I mean, there was a period of time that, you know, I almost picked up any Black Lizard novel that came out just because, oh, wow, this is like the legitimate pulp stuff, man.
Yeah, I discovered Jim Thompson for the first time through Black Lizard, you know, all of that stuff. And what was so interesting is that Sonny Mehta, who was of Knopf, which is one of the most, as you know, elevated publishers around, he just loved all that pulp stuff as well, which, you know, as you've done, kind of blurs the whole low and high art. Which I love about your work completely.
Oh, thank you. There was a neat quote that I think Kingsley Amis said when he wrote that James Bond novel, Colonel Sun.
Right.
And he said that, talking about the Ian Fleming books of James Bond, he goes, look, I'm here to tell you, as a professional author, anybody who writes books that this many people want to read, I'm interested in. The whole thing is to get people to want to read your book. When that many people want to read it, that's a thing. I think Jerry is far more eloquent than I am about the way he said it, but that was definitely the gist.
Going down a different track, you know, one of the things I loved in Reservoir Dogs was the whole beginning part of it, with Stephen Wright and all the music and the soundtracks. And soundtracks and music is so much a part of who you are and what you do. Have you ever thought about kind of trying to compose or get involved in the writing of music as well?
Not really. It's just not my thing. I like being an aficionado. I like being a curator.
Yeah.
But I've had some friends that are actually really like terrific producers and stuff. And if I really wanted to, they could show me how to operate the knobs on the board and stuff. But I kind of like being an arm's distance from it a little bit.
You talk about being a curator. Spotify just came out with like 50 hours of music from the James Baldwin estate. It was all the albums that he had when he died. And so you can actually get the entire playlist. I mean, I, for one, would love a Quentin Tarantino lifetime playlist of everything.
We had to move this back a little bit is because, like, I went and did a couple of shows at the Sirius XM. Yeah, they wanted me to pick some songs. I go, well, can I just bring some records over? And they go, yeah, sure, go ahead. And they go, well, we could, no, let's play my record so you hear it from my turntable. And, well, not my turntable, but my actual record.
Records.
Go, okay, sure, well, give us a little time. We got to hook it up. But we did it. It made it a really fun show. It was fun to, like, you know, give my little spiel and then, like, put the needle on the record and boom. It was a lot of fun.
When is that going to air? Do we know yet?
I think it should probably air like sometime in the next, like, I guess, 5 days.
Can you give us a hint of some of the people you played?
The pretext I used was songs from my soundtrack collection, where there was like a really good song buried on a soundtrack that no one would know unless they, you know, had that soundtrack album. I still have a bunch of albums that, like, I bought simply because it had one cool song that would be good to put on a mixtape for somebody.
Oh, that's great. You still have mixtapes. You still
Well, I still make mixtapes. I can't really give them to anybody because no one has a tape player anymore, but I still have a tape player in my car, so I'll make mixtapes for myself.
Oh, that is great. Yeah, I'm old enough that I remember 8-track.
I remember them. My mom had a few of them, though.
You know, music is so much part of all of our lives. And what you do through your curation and through your references is that you're teaching your audience as well.
Mm-hmm. No, that's very true. And it's very gratifying because we had a book signing just the other day. And there was all these, like, you know, people between 30 to 19. And they were coming up to me and they were just saying, you helped turn me on to movies. It was like seeing...
Right.
This movie you did, or that movie you did, and that's gratifying enough. But the idea that, well, like, after I saw your movie, then I was really interested in you, and then I listened to you give interviews, and you talked about this director, or this genre, or that subgenre, or this movie, or that movie. So then I went out and made a list, and went and started seeing those movies. I sent them on a whole journey, and just all these young people just kept saying that, like, again and again and again, as they came up with their book for me to sign. And it was like, you know, I mean, it was very moving and immensely gratifying.
What a great legacy, right?
It was pretty wonderful.
Yeah, no, you should feel, I mean, the excitement around your work and the excitement around this book, you should feel lots of gratification.
Oh, that's a really nice, I do feel that, but it's really nice that you say that. Thank you.
I can't have an interview as a bookseller without asking you about any, you know, and you had the great scene in the, you know, in the bookstore. What is your attitude? What is your feeling about bookstores? And are there any that you remember and that were influential? And
there's so many that I remember. If I could, if I had the money then I have now, I'd go back just before they close and buy their store. So they open.
Right.
Coming from the South Bay area of Los Angeles, around the Hermosa Beach area, there was this really magnificent bookstore called Either Or Books. And it was about like three stores. I think they bought three stores and just knocked down the walls. And made this one big, long store right where you could see the beach from the store. And it had new books and used books, all kind of mixed up together. It was terrific. It was just, it was an amazing store. And there was a time where, like, my first girlfriend was this really lovely, lovely woman. And she was going for her, you know, I was a high school dropout, and she was going for her professorship in English literature. So we would go to that bookstore when she was going to Santa Cruz College. You know, there was all these, like, great bookstores in that town. And then we would just go and buy about, like, six books or seven books and then come home. And then, like, you know, for the next 3 days, that's what we did.
That's great. There's that great bookshop that you probably went to. It was called Bookshop Santa Cruz, actually.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm sure that's the one I'm referring to.
Right downtown, yeah.
They had a really magnificent bookstore, and they had like a couple really magnificent used record stores that were just we loved. And there was that great Revival House, the old Sash Mill that we were seeing, you know, old movies at. That was just fantastic. And where I used to live in Greenwich Village, right off of Greenwich Avenue, there was a little tiny bookstore for just mystery books. It was called, I think, Mystery Press or something like that.
Yeah,
and it was just a little bookstore for mystery fiction and crime fiction.
Right. I think it became the Mysterious Press.
I think it did, yeah. It broke my heart about, like, I guess 6 years ago when I went down there and, like, it wasn't there anymore.
Yeah, I know. We've lost a lot of great indie bookstores. Yeah. But the good news, there are a lot that are kind of making another surge. A lot of younger people are coming in and opening up stores.
Very gratified when I saw the sales list, what they were ordering from HarperCollins as far as the book was concerned. And I expected the number to be big on Amazon or something like that. But I was really gratified when it comes to the independent mom and pop bookstores. It was a nice number there.
You were talking about going to used record stores and bookstores. There's something to be said for the analog world.
I'm definitely a champion of the analog world.
You know, the other thing that you do so well, too, is that you acknowledge the past. You involve people like Bruce Dern.
Yeah.
David Carradine, Burt Reynolds.
There is an aspect to the book that you know, maybe a third of the book that I've managed to turn into narrative is just a lot of old stories that those guys told me. All Hollywood stories that I was able to kind of twist and turn and make it a Rick Dalton story, or just make it a reflection of the industry. But they were literally just like, you know, great, because these guys are just magnificent raconteurs, and just the old stories about this actor or that actor or this person or that person or this situation or that situation is just, you know, the book is just filled with that. And that's, you know, so I'm really paying them a debt, because without them, the authenticity of the book wouldn't be there.
Have you ever been to Miami? Do you ever spend time
only
there?
I only was in Miami once, actually. It was, I produced a movie that was shot there, and so they had the big premiere, and then they were, and the guys were from Miami. They go, you gotta come on down. So I went down, and I had a fucking ball, and I've never been back again, but I had a ball.
But you guys, you should come. Your family would love it. You know, you know, particularly when your son gets a little older, you can take him to the beach. It's kind of a kick down here.
No, you're just saying that, and I believe you. I think that would be a lot of fun. Maybe in a couple of years, we'll do a real trip.
Do you have an idea of what's next? Do you know what's next? Do you think you're going to write more?
Just the cinema book. That's what I'm working on right now.
You're doing the cinema book, and there was some talk of a play as well.
Yeah, that'll probably be. I've already written it, so that'll probably be what I'll start exploring to do after I finish the cinema book. Yeah. Well, my book is about, you know, I think the 70s is the greatest decade of American movies ever. You know, and that's me coming of age. That's, to me, that's a movie.
Yeah.
That's what I first learned movies were. That's what I saw like week after week after week. I write about Bullet. I write about Getaway. I write about Love Story. I write about The Outfit. I write about another Donald Westlake movie, Hops and Robbers. I write about that. The Last Picture Show, Mean Streets, The Mac.
Some of the Sam Peckinpah
Rolling
stuff.
Yeah, Rolling Thunder. The only Peckinpah I write about is The Getaway, but I deal with him big time. I deal quite a bit with Don Siegel. So like, I write about Dirty Harry. I write about The Shootist.
Yeah, The Shootist, I remember. The Shootist.
Escape from Alcatraz. But like, even when I write about, like, Escape from Alcatraz, that gives me an excuse to write about all the prison movies that came out around that time. And then I get back again to Escape from Alcatraz.
Right. Is there anything you've seen recently that you've loved?
Not in that last year. I hardly saw anything in the last year, because I just, like, refused to pay $20 to stream a movie I don't know.
Right. Well, here, let me ask you an off-the-wall question. Uh-huh. So in the industry, so much seems to be moving toward television, right?
Yeah.
Have you ever had any interest in doing a limited series or a series or anything like that?
In the past, I could have done something like that. Like when I first came up with Inglourious Basterds, I had this like big, grander idea. And like, if it was an option to do a miniseries, I probably would have done it as a miniseries at that time.
Right. You have nothing philosophical against it, necessarily.
No, not necessarily. No. When I wrote the script for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, just for fun, because I watched so many of the 50s Western shows to like kind of really, I always liked them anyway, but just to indoctrinate myself into that world, I watched so many of them that just for fun, I wrote 5 episodes of Bounty Law. And so it's like they're all like, you know, circa 1958, 59, and they're all about a half hour long, black and white shows.
Cool.
And yeah. I might end up doing all 5 episodes, or like a couple more, and you know, just because they're cool, they're fun, they'd be worth doing. One of the things I was really drawn by watching stuff like Wanted Dead or Alive, or watching Tales of Wells Fargo, or watching The Rifleman, was these half-hour westerns, and the fact that like they pack so much story in that half hour that, you know, Meeves makes, you know, everything is like a, you know, trying to be a big epic. I was so taken with the idea of telling this big impactful story in 22 minutes.
Right. Yeah, no, they're always clever.
And they were dynamite, man.
Yeah.
You know, they cut out all the middles of everything. It's just like right to the fucking action and right to the drama and right to the characters. It was half the reason I wrote the thing was for the edification of it all, but the other was just to experiment with that type of storytelling.
Oh, I hope it comes to fruition. I hope somebody does it. You know, when I grew up, I had the flip side of that, and I had the bonanza side.
Yeah.
There wasn't a whole lot of action always. There was always some scurrilous thing going on, but they were trying to make some kind of ethical point, which was always sort of interesting. It was always on Sunday night, which made
sense. Well, the thing always bugged me about like Bonanza and a lot of those shows of that era is like Hoss would fall in love with some woman or Little Joe would fall in love with some woman and they'd end up dying at the end of the episode and then they never brought them up again.
Out of sight, out of mind, right?
Yeah, it seemed like he was truly in love with her and there should be the tragedy that informs the rest of his life and she's never referred to, she's never brought up again. It's like nothing that ever happens is ever brought up again.
Right, that's very funny. That's really true. That is what happened. Man, I so appreciate this, Quinn.
Oh, and, my pleasure, man. This is a very fun conversation. It's been great talking to you.
You too, Quinn. My very best to you.